My name is Michael Pellet, and I'm from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. I teach at the university up there, and I'm also the pastor of a small Lutheran congregation in Saskatoon. And this week, it's my privilege to be leading the Bible study with you. And what I'm going to try to do is look at the Gospel of Mark, which is the primary gospel for this cycle of the church year, and look at it from the perspective of community, or the theme here for the Holden Summer Program, No Longer Strangers. So looking at some of the things in Mark's gospel and what we can learn from the Gospel of Mark about community. And so this morning, what I would like to do is provide a brief overview of Mark's gospel in terms of how from the very beginning, Mark starts constituting us as hearers and readers of this gospel as community, and then look at one of the key passages and perhaps the most obvious passage in Mark, where he talks about community and an understanding of leadership within community, which is the end of the third passion prediction in Mark chapter 10. And if we can work our way through all of that, then certainly we deserve coffee. So to begin, I'd like you to turn, please, to Mark chapter 1, verse 1, which sounds like a good place to begin. And if someone would please read Mark 1, 1.
The beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
Okay. There's a real attention grabber, isn't there? Right? Doesn't seem to be that dynamic of a beginning. In fact, it seems to be almost as dynamic as saying, let's begin the tape now. Right? Which is kind of what Mark is saying. That he asserts, okay, here's the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And yet we have no context for that, or we're almost just literally thrown into this. Where are we beginning here? We're beginning, and yet there seems to be no past, no context, but yet since we're told it's the beginning, we have something important. And so we figure, oh, well, if this is the beginning, there must be a middle and an end coming. So all of a sudden, I better pay attention. So the first way in which Mark gets us together is a very kind of innocuous way to say, okay, this is the beginning, and we're there. But there's also something else there. Already in this first verse, Mark tells us something that no one else in this gospel knows. Do you know what that is?
Jesus is the Son of God.
Jesus is the Son of God. So already we know something no one else, none of the primary characters yet in the gospel know. And so, since we know something no one else knows, what does that make us?
Really smart.
Smart. We're the smart. And I want to get this out on the table right away. We're the experts. So I have no fear at all this week, knowing that there's this community of experts here who know it all from the beginning. Which is also great Mark and irony. Mark uses a lot of irony in his gospel. Irony is a rhetorical device where you say one thing and kind of mean the opposite. And so Mark is always engaging in that kind of irony to get us to think about things. Mark's gospel, in terms of a sense of community, is always asking us to look at what's the relationship between insiders and outsiders. And in Mark's gospel, the outsiders always become the insiders, and the insiders become the outsiders, who again become the insiders, and yet still seem to be the outsiders. And if you're not confused yet, we're going to look at Mark's gospel some more to make sure you really leave confused. Because there's a little bit of confusion that Mark wants us to have as we begin to work our way through. Remember, right here as we're starting the gospel, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, as we started there, we were outsiders beginning to come in. And so we might say, well, I've only read the first verse. I'm kind of an outsider. I don't know what's going on here. On the other hand, you're the experts. You're the insiders because you know something no one else yet knows in this whole gospel. And so you're the most inside of insiders. The disciples certainly don't know that Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus himself, if you will, doesn't even know that he's the Son of God until verse 9. So you're already 8 verses ahead of Jesus. Think about that, right? Take a look there at chapter 1, verse 9. This is the story of the baptism of Jesus. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee, was baptized by John in the Jordan, and just as he was coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens. Very specific here. Now, Jesus is the only one who is going to see and hear what's going on. He saw the heavens torn apart, the Spirit descending like a dove on him, and a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, the Beloved. With you I am well pleased." Okay, so now Jesus also knows he's the Son of God. That's been revealed and disclosed to him. So now at least there's two of us who know what's going on. When others know what's going on, it's always they're the outsiders. Who else, as we start working through Mark's gospel, and those of you who know a little bit about Mark's gospel, what's the next group or bunch of folks or beings that know that Jesus is the Son of God?
Demons.
The demons. They say, "We know who you are." And Jesus tells them what?
Shut up.
So there's an interesting question. Are demons insiders or outsiders? We then go and get through the middle of Mark's gospel. Well, we can go to like the stilling of the storm. And Jesus stills the storm. And stilling the storm, the disciples in the boat, right, go, "Who is this?" And they keep asking that question throughout the rest of the gospel. Who is this man? So they still don't know. We can get to chapter 8. We have Peter's great confession. Jesus asks his disciples, who do people say that I am? And they give all sorts of, well, you're Isaiah, you're Jeremiah, you're a great prophet. Peter says, "You are the Christ." And Jesus says, "Right." But on the other hand, Peter gets it all wrong. Because once Peter says, "You are the Christ," Jesus says, "Right answer, Peter. And because I am the Christ, I must go to Jerusalem and suffer and die and be raised again." At which point Peter takes Jesus aside and says, "Oh, well, no, Jesus, you've got the game plan all wrong." Which means still, Peter doesn't understand who this Jesus is and what it's all about. And so still throughout the rest of the gospel, there is this question no one seems to understand until we get to chapter 15, verse 39. And if someone would read that, please.
"Now when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, 'Truly this man was God's son.'"
Okay. So we've got a centurion who now says, "Son of God." And is the centurion an insider or an outsider?
An outsider.
In many senses, you can't get much more of an outsider than this centurion. On the other hand, what makes this centurion an insider? What did he see? And what did he hear?
He knows it's the Son of God.
Yeah, but how does he know that? Lucky guess?
Yeah.
It's the thunder and the sky, the earthquake and...
Thunder and the earthquake? Is that what convinced him?
I don't know. Partly.
He saw how Jesus breathed his last. Somehow, Mark wants to claim that what makes outsiders insiders and where that whole transition goes on is focused in the cross. Somehow, in some way, the crucifixion of Jesus makes all the difference in the world. That somehow we're going to be able to figure out how to live as a community of faith and how to understand ourselves as a community of faith when we are cross-constituted. And so the key thing that I think we need to keep in mind all week long as we kind of plunk down in different places here in Mark's gospel to understand his sense of community and community of faith is to always understand or begin to understand what it is to be a cross-constituted community. A cross-constituted community means somehow that we understand who Jesus is and therefore understand who we are. And so that's where Mark is going to push us. This is what Mark is going to try to help us understand. As Mark talks about the parables and begins to explain them, he has this little phrase from Jesus. This is chapter 4, verse 24. In the middle of it, explaining parables, in verse 23, he says, "Let anyone with ears to hear listen." And he said to them, "Pay attention to what you hear." Or literally, in the Greek, that "pay attention" is a verb for seeing. And what Jesus is telling the disciples is, watch what you hear. Isn't that a wonderfully mixed metaphor? Watch what you hear. In other words, again, think about that in terms of the cross. and the crucifixion. What enabled that centurion to make that confession is he was watching what he was hearing. We still kind of have that expression if I say something like, "Do you see what I'm saying?" Think about that in terms of we then too, as the community of faith, I think, need to be aware of the fact that others around us will be watching what they hear us say. In other words, what communicates is not just merely the verbal expression, but it's the whole action. Our saying and doing, word and deed go together so that we can talk about watch what you hear is talking about the whole sense of action. And in Hebrew, again, the sense of word is an active dynamic understanding. The word engages in and enables action. Think about that. The easiest kind of thing is to think about that in terms of a notion of promise. A promise can be verbal, but it also leads to action and leads to a way in which we orient and direct ourselves. For example, if I make you the promise to say, "Those who bear with me all week will get free ice cream on Friday. I promise." Now that word of promise could, if it were really true, orient your action. That promises orient our actions. Another example of promise that comes through here is, again, the notion of marriage. What is the true moment of marriage is that verbal promise that these two people make to one another in public when they say, "I do. I take you as my husband, I take you as my wife." That promise orients their action for the rest of their life. From then on, right, watch what you hear. It's a married couple. That's how, and same here, now Mark is telling us that God's promises through the cross, those words, those active words, are going to orient our lives, our action as community. And so it's bringing together again that sense of cross and promise as a communal action. Now, so far, that seems to be pretty clear. So now we're going to have to muddy the waters a little bit. And if you would, please, turn to Mark chapter 4, verses 10 through 12, and 33 to 34. And if someone would read that.
When he was alone, those who were around him along with the 12 asked him about the parables. And he said to them, "To you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God. But for those outside, everything comes in parables, in order that they may indeed look but not perceive, and may indeed listen but not understand, so that they may not turn again and be forgiven." And
33 to 34.
"With many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. And he did not speak to them except in parables, but he explained everything in private to his disciples."
Wow, those are kind of perplexing passages. Mm-hmm. That first one is, you can see Jesus tells a parable. When he's alone, those who are around him ask him, what's it mean? Already, again, I think here kind of Mark's irony to think about the smugness of who we think we are as community, and at the same time, our ignorance. I'm sure you found yourself in a kind of situation where someone is talking and you really don't know what's going on, but you sit there very knowledgeably, right? Yes. You know, you always keep nothing. Yes, sir. Well, of course, yes. That's obvious. And then once everybody leaves, then you kind of sneak up to the speaker and say, "What were you talking about?" Right? That's Mark's first image there of the disciples, because after all, they are disciples. I mean, just like you, right? I mean, this is us again. Remember, we're the experts. We're the know-it-alls. We've got our act together. And isn't that often the way the community of faith, the church, acts? As if we know it all, and we've got our act together, and we have the truth. No uncertainty, no doubt, no reason for questioning. We've got it.
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, the Jesus stuff? Yes, I understand. Gospel thing? Oh, yes, I understand the gospel. That's very simple, very simple.
And then, all of a sudden, or not so all of a sudden, when really being confronted with the gospel in a particular situation, we say, well, I don't know, what is this? What's going on here? Do I really understand? How is it that God is working graciously in this promissory way? I need a little help here. And so they come to Jesus, and Jesus is explaining it to them, willing to help them understand. We have that sense there both in verse 11 and in verse 33, right? He explains to them as they're able to hear it, and so on and so forth. And yet, verse 12, where Mark is quoting from the prophet Isaiah, that explanation that, but they still look but not perceive, listen but not understand, that they may not turn again and be forgiven. Now, what's going on there? Is Jesus purposefully deceiving, deluding, confusing? How could it be that the word could not be perceived or understood?
It's as if he's creating outsiders in order that there be insiders, that there's a difference being created. I'm not sure what the purpose of creating the difference is.
Okay, so Jesus is purposefully creating insiders and outsiders? Anyone else? Yes, please.
Sounds like he's concerned some folks haven't paid their dues.
Some folks haven't paid their dues. And if you don't pay your dues, you don't get the goodies, right? So much for unconditional grace in a free gospel, huh?
Well, you said we had to be here every day in order to get that ice cream.
That was it. I know. That's why I also gave the disclaimer. Yeah. Note the condition, right? That was not an unconditional promise. That was a conditional promise. That was a deal.
And hypothetical to boot.
And hypothetical. So it was pretty lame. But what else? What else do you think Jesus is trying to do here? Get us to think about.
Michael, mm-hmm. I've thought about this before this, and it seems to me that there's something basically right about Jesus taking the the understanding away from the lecture. I don't know if this is a critique against practices, educational practices in those days.
Oh, be careful here now.
I know. But it seems to me that there's something about leading people into understanding on their own behalf, understanding on the basis of what they see and what they experience, rather than receiving it from the teacher's book or the educational book. It's a difficulty because, of course, here he is, the word, but there's a sense in which until they're ready to understand and experience it, they're kept from it. They can't just know the book learning.
I think that's half of it. That there's a difference that Mark wants us to get to see between knowing that, knowing how, and my way of putting it here for Mark, knowing on the way, which is where Mark wants us to get. Knowing that, that's a way of knowing truth that's basically in terms of propositional truth. If we want to put that in terms of our own community of faith, let's say that would be knowing in terms of doctrine, in terms of teaching. And that somehow that kind of knowing that is, okay, we're all able to recite the Apostles' Creed. We are all able to give wonderful explanations on the understanding of the Trinity and all that kind of stuff, right? We know all of that. But Mark's sense of that kind of knowing, while fine, is not really the sense of knowing that he says keeps us together as community. That kind of knowing that, a kind of community that is held together in this way, again, is a community that is held together basically in terms of information. And so now we can say, I know something you don't know. And another way we keep ourselves together in terms of that kind of information, I'll put it in a bit of a pejorative way, we've all got a jargon. And I'm sure you've experienced that too, that someone who is not a Christian at all, who comes to your communities of faith, is truly perplexed. What do we mean by all these words? And we, for us, it's very common, ordinary language, and yet there's a lot of jargon involved in our theology and things like that. As there are in other communities that are based on profession and try to hold themselves together. I mean, what makes geologists a particular community? Well, they've got plate tectonics and all this other, who knows what, esoteric language. Or what keeps physicians together, right? Well, look at that wonderful jargon that if you don't have Greek or Latin, who knows what it is. Right. And all of those, that's one way of holding yourselves together as community. Another way of holding yourselves together as community is a sense of knowing how. That's what holds you together, is that you have certain kind of techniques in common. That might be, let's say, in terms of Christian communities, liturgies. Whether you're high church or low church or, you know, snake handlers or whatever, right? You've got a certain kind of technique. Or there are other communities, again, that are held together by techniques. piano players, all of whom from the virtuoso to the one who just pounds out chopsticks. They still have some sense of technique. There's that knowing how to play piano, and therefore you can be that kind of community. Jesus is saying, our community is not based on a knowing that and a knowing how, but it is a knowing on the way. That this is one of the phrases that whenever Mark begins a transition for Jesus, whenever there's something significant happening, it's always Jesus is on the way or on the road. In Greek, that notion of on the way or on the road is Exodus. Uh-oh, now there's something going on, isn't there? Right? Mark wants to talk about an Exodus knowing. Just like the Hebrews came out of Egypt and on that Exodus, and through that traveling, through being on the way, they got to know who God is and what God does. Whether that's the Passover or the deliverance at the Red Sea or the giving of the covenant at Sinai or the furnishing of manna and on, it's through being on the way that they learned who God is and what God is all about. So for us, I think Mark is saying what constitutes the Christian community is that we are always people of faith who are on the way. And as we encounter various situations, whatever they might be, constituted by the cross, we truly perceive and understand when we see what that cruciform life is like on the way. That Mark's understanding of church, I think, is that we are always church under the cross and in the world. We are a people on the way. And so it also fits again with this sense of homelessness or exiles. We don't plunk down roots and that kind of security and stability like a knowing that and a knowing how community may do. But we are a community that is always on the way, moving. And so that way, again, that insiders-outsiders dynamic is always there. The other half, and I think, Carol, that's how I understand what you're talking about. The other half of this.
I think the difficulty for me is to get out of saying those very non-Lutheran things like experiential. But there is something about just living the life.
Right. That sense in terms of living under the promise,
yeah,
living in grace, and you can only do that on the way. You can't plan that ahead of time. I can't say, well, let me tell you my game plan for how I will live under unconditional grace on July, what is today, the 7th?
7th.
July 7th, 1999. I have no idea what grace-filled living will be 2 years from now. 2 years from now, I hope that will be the case, right? But I can't make plans in that way. That it happens as you go along. That grace that is there. I think that's the first half of it. The other half of it goes back again to Mark's irony in the sense that the disciples just don't get it. And this now becomes an indictment to all of us, Mark 1:1 experts. Okay, you know Jesus is the Son of God. And you know that the cross is what constitutes us as community. Now you have seen that, and yet there seems to be so many things happening in your life that you don't perceive it. You have heard that, and yet there seems to be so many things going on that you don't understand it. What's the matter with you? Why are you such hard-hearted, stiff-necked, hard-of-hearing people? The example here again is to say, let me go to the first passion prediction, which is in Mark chapter 8, verses 32 and following, where Jesus asks, again, who do people say I am? Peter says, you are the Christ. And, you know, great. And then Jesus gives the passion prediction, and Peter says, oh, no, 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 you can't do that, Jesus. Now, why is it that Peter, who has been following Jesus all along, when he hears the way of the cross, says no? Why doesn't he perceive? Why doesn't he understand? If you will, Peter's response to Jesus' word of the cross is denial. Where does Peter's denial begin? It doesn't begin in the courtyard of the high priest back there in chapter 14. It happens right here already in chapter 8. And it continues to unfold until we get to chapter 14 and the high priest courtyard. And the other disciples, when they hear that, will see their response to all of this stuff is fear. And that fear leads all the way again to chapter 14, where they are scattered and they desert Jesus. But where does that desertion begin? That starts here already in chapter 8, and it unfolds. And so for us as a community, when we hear that word of the cross, and what that means, that our community is begins and ends with the cross, what is our initial and often our most basic response to that? I think I summarize it in the word resistance. We don't want to go that way. That knowing on the way is, yes, words that we can hear and perceive, but do we understand? No. Because again, understanding, knowing on the way, if you watch what you are hearing, understanding always leads to action. Even in our most simple language. If I would say to someone, would you please open the door? How do I know that you understand that? You get up and open the door. Or how do I know that you really understand that what I meant here was just an illustration and I didn't really want you to open the door is you didn't move at all. Right? Proper understanding. That action is understanding. Okay, so here are the disciples, and they've heard all of Jesus' parables, and he explains them to them, and they followed him, and they've seen all this action and what Jesus does. And what is their response? Is it action that fits knowing on the way? Is it understanding? No, it's the very opposite of that. It's denial, fear, desertion, it's resistance all the way. And often is that not the case for us as communities of faith? That we are communities of resistance in the bad sense of the word. Not resisting the principalities and powers and all those others out there that are against God, but what? We are the ones who resist God. We are the ones that say, oh no, not this way, not the way of the cross. I'm sorry, but I can't do that. Yeah, I know I'm the expert in that you're the Son of God, but you see, the Son of God happens to be wrong at this point. Just like Peter would say, yeah, I know you're the Christ, but you've got it wrong, Jesus. Let me correct you.
So another way to go at that denial thing, that was the first thing that occurred to me when you set it up, and that is that Peter didn't deny Jesus because he didn't hear him. He denied him because he already knew what the answer was. The messianic hope was quite vivid among the Jews at that time, and the idea that the Messiah was a very successful conqueror kind of person was an idea Peter probably had. So when he said that Jesus was the Messiah, he had the rest of the story already worked out.
Right.
And I think that may also be part of our problem.
Okay. Yeah, but because it's experts, the wrong story.
That's right. That's our experts already. We already know what the answer is.
Right.
And so we don't learn on the way.
And so in that sense, we're not listening again at that point, right? Not truly perceiving and understanding. And so I think that that's what this passage is about. It's not Jesus trying to deceive us or lead us down the wrong path or play games with our mind or however you want to look at them. But it's that sense of acknowledging that when the truth is told, our initial and perhaps final response is one of resistance and rejection. And in that sense, again, it's not just the outsiders that reject, it's the insiders that resist and reject. If you would turn, please, to chapter 10. I've got to keep moving here or else I'll get bogged down on one thing. Chapter 10, verses 32 and following. This is the third passion prediction. And to make a few points here. The first thing is that, again, in verse 32, note as it introduces this third passion prediction, all of these kind of key phrases that I've been talking about are all brought together by Mark into this one verse. Right? They were on the road, on the way. It's the Exodus, going up to Jerusalem, right? So there's that sense of the cross there in the background. Jesus was walking ahead of them. Jesus is the leader. And again, this is a favorite phrase in Mark. Jesus walking ahead, going before, going in, as Susan mentioned last night in the resurrection narrative, the young man at the tomb tells the women that Jesus will be going before you, going ahead of you to Galilee. I'll be talking about that phrase too later this week. And as Jesus is walking ahead of them, as they're on the way, the disciples are what? Amazed, and those who followed were afraid. Isn't that wonderful? Both and. They're amazed and afraid. And again, perhaps a way of characterizing us as community. That on the one hand, knowing Jesus, the Son of God, knowing the way of the cross, knowing the sense of unconditional grace and promise is amazing. But also, we're just scared out of our minds by that, aren't we? We're really afraid of what that kind of cross-constituted living might be all about. Jesus takes the 12 aside again. So there you've got our little insiders, and tells them what's going to happen to him. Again, he's going to be handed over to the chief priests, scribes. They'll condemn him to death. He'll be handed over to the Gentiles. They'll mock him, spit upon him, flog him, kill him. After 3 days, he will rise again. Right? Very specific. Right? So if you've heard what's going to happen, and then what happens? Verse 35. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come forward to him and say to him, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Boy, they sure didn't hear it, did they? Isn't that great? What a great request. It's though I would come to you today and say to one of you, Diane, I'd like you to leave me a blank check. She's smiling at least. Right? I mean, I know very little about Diane. What?
It wouldn't be worth much. That's why I'm smiling.
That's all right. I'll accept it. I mean, think about that. I mean, that's basically what they're asking. We want a blank check. And Jesus' response to this is he plays along with them. What is it you want me to do for you? Sure, you want a blank check? I'll give you a blank check. And now to show how James and John haven't understood anything, they say, grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. Now Jesus has just said, here's what's going to happen to me. Condemned to death, mocked, spit, flogged, killed. And they say, hey, we want your glory. There's a little irony, because they're not saying, gee, Jesus, can we get mocked, spit upon, and killed just like you? Right? Total misunderstanding, total misperception there. And so at that point, Jesus says, verse 38, you do not know what you are asking. And he uses two motifs there of drinking the cup that I drink, baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with, in turn to show his way, following to get what Jesus gets, means suffering. And they again are so muddle-headed, they just say, oh yeah, we're able to do that. Yeah, yeah, sure, sure. No problemo. We can do that. And Jesus then says, indeed, that will be the case, that suffering too will be part of your life in my community. But to sit at my right hand or left hand, I can't grant that. Right. Suffering, I can promise. Glory, I can't. Then verse 41. When the 10 heard this, they began to be angry with James and John. Again, that phrase, they began to be angry, can also be translated as they expressed their displeasure to each other. So kind of like two things are going on here. The first one is, can you imagine Peter when he finds out that James and John ask that? I mean, Peter, he can just go, oh! Why didn't I do that? I should have been asking for the glory. Why did I let Jim and Jack get ahead of me here? Right? I mean, I imagine Peter is really upset that, you know, someone else got ahead of him in the glory game. The other thing that's going on, that of course, James and John did that. The other 10 are upset. So what are they going to do? Are they going to go and tell Jesus that they're upset? Of course not. They're going to go and start complaining to one another and start planning their own little coup d'etats and try to gain their own little juntas to undertake and control this stuff. And isn't that the way it works in most communities? When you see somebody who's getting a little overly ambitious, trying just a little too hard to be church council president, that reaction of either, oh, why didn't I try for that? Or, Well, you know, if those folks are going to take charge of the council, well, and we plan our own little juntas, that the whole sense of glory and seeking of glory always fragments community. It breaks us apart. It shows us again our own self-centeredness. Because glory is always for me, not for the other or for the sake of the other. And sometimes I'm willing enough that if I can't get the glory all by myself, that I do need a little group of Confederates. Well, sure, I'll bring you along, because if I do have to share the glory in order to get the glory, well, okay, I'll do that. But then maybe I can get rid of you later on along the way. Glory is a very selfish kind of thing, which again shows James and John and the other disciples, right? They're no better. They just didn't get it. They didn't understand what a cross-constituted community of faith is about. They're seeking glory. And so the disciples are angry. This is going on, verse 42 then. Jesus calls them together. Already that sense of the community, the little insiders, are already so fragmented that the only thing now that holds them together when they're all busy glory seeking is the voice of Jesus himself. Right. That is there any chance of bringing all of us glory seekers back together again? Yes, there is. But we have to be called by the word of Jesus. It's that word of the gospel that hopefully can again cut through all our glory seeking, all that resistance that we had. Well, that's already gone. All that resistance that we had. And again, reconstitute us as that community of faith. And so in verse 42, Jesus again snipes at them. You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. In Greek, again, those words about lording over and tyrants over them have a Greek preface that has the notion of down. It's an authority that puts people down. Right? That sense of how do we get somebody under our thumb? That's the way the Romans work, right? They got to get you under their thumb so that they can control you. That notion of authority as domination, as power over, as putting down is always a sense of control. It's not really leadership, but it's control. And the way you can control people is always through force. It's a sense of power that entails force, and finally, the kind of force that will always work is violence. As opposed to a sense of empowerment and an understanding of leadership and that Jesus wants in his community, where he says in verse 43 again, the great irony, you know, okay, all those Romans and all those Gentiles, they use put down domination and authority. But of course, that's not the way it is among you. You're certainly not like them, right? They just were. But then, whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant. And the word there for servant, diakonos, is in English the word we use for deacon, or in Holden Village, villagees, it's waitri. Right. Whoever would become great among you must be your waitry. And there are two other places in Mark's gospel where he uses this word deacon. Chapter 1, verse 31, and chapter 15, verse 41. And if someone would look up 131 and someone 1541 and just read those for us, please.
One thirty-one. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. Then the fever left her, and she began to serve them.
Okay, thank you. And she began to serve them. That's that word, deacon. And 1541.
These used to follow him and provided for him when he was in Galilee. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem.
Okay, thank you. That word provided for is again in Greek the verb deacon, waitry. What's the subject of that verb in both of those verses? Well, who are the subjects of that verb of served and provided for?
Jesus and the disciples.
No.
Women.
Right. Who served Jesus here? Peter's mother-in-law, who provided for Jesus always on the way? Women. And what kind of women were they? I mean, like, think about here in 1541, the folks who are named, what do we know about them? About those women. We don't know much at all, but what little bit do we know about them?
Followed.
They followed Jesus, but in terms of the women themselves, what do we know?
Well, one's a prostitute.
One's a prostitute. Yeah. What else? Anything? Mother? Yeah, but and they're even what kind of mother?
Unwed.
Could be unwed. Yeah. And some of them, too, were widows. I mean, if we take Mary, the mother of Jesus, she's probably a widow by this time. In other words, these women who follow Jesus, Peter's mother-in-law, it sounds like she's a widow, are not even just simply second-class citizens, they're third-class. Of course, the best citizen you could be would be to be male. Then the best you could have for a woman would be if she were a married woman. And then third class citizen would be a widow or a single woman. And maybe even that place, fourth class. If you want to think of Mary Magdalene in this sense, as prostitute or whatnot, we're working way down here at the bottom of the heap. So compare widows, single women, and prostitutes to who's at the top of this pyramid, right? Caesar and the Gentiles and the put-down folk. What type of authority and leadership is Jesus asking us to exercise in our community? This kind of leadership. And the ones who even come close, I mean, talk about a put down to male disciples again. Who are even come close to exercising this kind of leadership within Jesus' own time? Women. The men disciples just strike out. They are just such dolts. They don't hear, they don't see, they don't perceive, they don't understand, and they don't even know how to lead. Think about the way that undercuts the politics of the time, even the politics of our time. Politically, what does this mean? Certainly, patriarchy takes it pretty hard here, doesn't it? And even the understanding now of the great disciples in the community, right? The great men of faith, Peter, James, John, who are supposedly the inner circle and the insiders, aren't considered really, from Mark's understanding, to be the ones who even exercise the qualities of leadership. So what kind of insiders are they? Who are the real leaders? The deacons, the waitries, those who know how to serve. And so a cross-constituted community on the way, what do they know how to do? What is that Exodus kind of knowing? They are the community that knows how to serve. And if you know how to serve, then you are, as a community, beginning to perceive and to understand who Jesus as the Son of God is and what the way of the cross is all about. There's leadership in the Christian community. Well, the bell has rung, and I certainly do not want to put you down such that you cannot have coffee. So if you'd like to stay around and talk a little more about it, I'm happy to do so, or we can pick it up some other time, pick it up again tomorrow. But thank you.
Thank you.